sensitive to the accusation, the answer to such concerns is to intervene swiftly and decisively when the subject is obviously not answering the question asked. O'Brien, I'll ask them when they're here, Nigel, but I'm talking about your party today. Farage, but that's the point. Nobody ever does ask them, and that's the point I'm making. This is so obviously untrue, it barely merits a response. O'Brien, so what happens to John Lyndon Sullivan now? Farage, he will face a disciplinary charge on whether he's brought the party into disrepute. O'Brien, the tweet was on the 17th of February, 3 months earlier. Farage, was it? I don't know. O'Brien, what about the small business spokesman who employed 7 illegal immigrants? Farage, be a little bit careful on that story, you know. He founded a business which he's no longer a director of. His sons run it. They have got a big row going on. Again, any reluctance to interrupt obvious obfuscation is a betrayal of journalistic standards that Farage has come to rely on. All you need to undo it is facts. O'Brien, he resigned, to be clear, as a director of the company 3 days after the immigration raid. Farage, yeah, I know that. He's resigned as a director, O'Brien, after the immigration raid. Note now how effortlessly he moves from an argument that failed because it was spurious to an entirely different one that doesn't stand up to scrutiny either. Farage, yeah, but he wasn't responsible for the day-to-day running of it. However, I've spoken to him this morning. He says they made checks and are in dispute with the immigration authorities and they've gone to appeal, so we'll have to see how that plays out. But that doesn't make him an idiot, you know? O'Brien, what does it make him? Farage, well, we don't know, you know. Let's find out what happens here. My argument, James, is this. Wherever we have found people who have had extreme, racist, unpleasant views, we've unceremoniously got rid of them. Furthermore, I've tried to protect the party by making it absolutely clear that anybody that had previously been a member of the BNP or organisations like that cannot even join as a member. And to hold up the views of a handful of people as being representative of UKIP, frankly, isn't the truth. O'Brien. Well, okay, what about your associations with the BNP? If we go back to 1997, when you had lunch with a chap called Mark Devin, who, as you know, was responsible for writing an astonishing article, his expose of Jews in the media was called Mind Benders, you were photographed with him, and it was reported at the time that you were a man who often used words such as nignog and the N-word in the pub after committee meetings. And a month after that lunch, Devin wrote an article for the far-right journal Spearhead suggesting the BNP and UKIP get into bed together. How does something like that happen? Farage, because Mr. Devin was brought into the centre of UKIP by a chap at the time who was the leader, and turned out to be something very different. And I've never seen him since that day. O'Brien, no, the lunch you had with him was after he was exposed. Again, note how quickly he abandons one ploy and moves immediately to another bout of bogus victimhood. Farage, yeah, I wanted to find out why. O'Brien, find out why what? Farage, why somebody like him who had been held up to me as a great academic who was going to make a very big difference, O'Brien, but you'd seen what he'd written, the grand plan, the origins of non-white immigration. Farage, I wanted to find out what on earth had made somebody change their point of view. Nothing more than that. I haven't spoken to him since. As for the allegations, you know, as to what I said in the pub after a committee meeting, you will not find a single other member of that committee who makes that allegation. O'Brien, Alan Sked has, the founder of UKIP. Farage, yes, I know. Well, in politics, all sorts of disappointments happen to people and they throw mud. O'Brien, yes, I know. So what about the mud that's been thrown about the far-right parties with which you sit in Europe? The Danish People's Party, the True Finns Party, the Dutch SPG, perhaps most interestingly, the Liga Nord. I think you co-chair, don't you? That group with Francesco Speroni, who described Anders Breivik as someone whose ideas were in defence of Western civilization? Farage, no, he didn't, actually. One of his members did, and we kicked him out of the group. O'Brien, no. No, you're thinking of Mario Borghezio, who went further and said in a radio interview that Breivik had some excellent ideas. Farage, if you were to come with me to Italy or Poland or Slovakia and listen to the political discourse, you would realise how incredibly different it is to what we would consider to be acceptable in this country. We have said that we will not sit with the Front National and parties like the Austrian Freedom Party. We are not a party that wants to be linked to the far right. In March 2017, Farage conducted a radio interview with Front National leader Marine Le Pen, in which he praised her connection with the French people, while she thanked him for showing us the way out of this huge prison. She was referring to the EU. Although largely as a consequence of observing the reality of Brexit, her party's position on Frexit soon softened to the point of disappearance. O'Brien, I think the phrase you used when challenging me to this debate was members of the political class and their friends in the media. So let's run through that. You currently write columns in The Express and The Independent every week. Farage, yes. As for the political class, look, you know, I was in business. I have actually given up and sacrificed a huge amount. O'Brien, have you? Because the last business you were involved in, I think you resigned as company secretary 6 weeks before it was wound up by the Inland Revenue. Farage, no, that was the last company I was a director of, okay? The last company I ran was my own company, which I ran for 9 years and which closed down in good standing. This 9 years, as far as I can tell, is the sole foundation of his frequent insistence that he is somehow not a career politician. O'Brien, okay, so you weren't company secretary of Farage and Farage. I was company secretary. O'Brien, and you resigned 6 weeks before... Farage, I didn't make any money. It was a non-income related job. I wasn't paid a penny for being company secretary. O'Brien, presumably because if they owed 120 grand to the Inland Revenue, there wasn't any money around to pay you anything. Let me just move on then to that invitation to go overseas and listen to conversations in other countries where perhaps far-right politics are not viewed as askance as they are in this country. You've mentioned your discomfort at listening to foreign languages on a train recently. Farage, I made the point that I got on a train and went for several stops and there were a lot of people around me and no one spoke English. And I thought, you know, this is... I didn't object to it. I felt slightly uncomfortable. O'Brien, your wife is a German speaker. Farage, well, my children are too, yeah. O'Brien, does that make you feel uncomfortable? Farage, no, because they can speak English. O'Brien, well, how do you know those people on the train couldn't? Farage, well, maybe they could, but I got the distinct feeling that it certainly wasn't their language of choice. And if you look at the primary school situation in the East End of London, you know, where you've now got schools where a majority don't speak English, doesn't that say, O'Brien, the schools you refer to, the pupils you refer to, are registered and recorded as having English as a second language? They're not registered and recorded as not being able to speak English. Your own children would fit into that category. Farage, ah, well... Hopefully lots of people can speak lots of different languages. But the point I'm making is, do we want to live in an integrated... O'Brien, no. No, forgive me, but the point you're making is that schools in the East End are full of children who can't speak English. I just want you to recognise that's not true, what you've just said. The children who are typified as speaking English as a second language would include your own daughters, their mother tongue being German. Farage, they come from homes where English is most definitely not the first language and in too many cases is not the language at all. O'Brien, but no one's counted how many people are in the second category. Farage, they haven't, no. And it would be very helpful and useful if they did. And perhaps we'd be even more surprised and even more shocked. O'Brien, or perhaps we'd realise that most bilingual children in this country are children like yours. Farage, let's turn it round the other way, shall we? O'Brien, yes, let's. Farage, let's talk about immigration. O'Brien, if that was the debate that you'd offered to have on this programme, we'd have it now. But what the caller asked you was why so many people think you're racist. And part of the answer would be that you talk about children who can't speak English as a first language without mentioning that it includes your own children. Farage, I mean, what is racism? You know, is racism between races? O'Brien, don't you know? How can you say you're not something when you don't know what it is? Farage, is race about colour? Is race about race? Or is it about nationality? You know, I made a comment that wasn't intended to say any more, that I felt uncomfortable about the rate and pace of change and numbers of people. O'Brien, no, you felt uncomfortable about people speaking foreign languages, despite the fact that presumably your own wife does when she phones home to Germany. Farage, I don't suppose she speaks it on the train, you know, and that's the point I was making. O'Brien, well, why not? Is she not allowed to? And what about the line about not wanting to live next door to Romanians? Farage, I was asked if a group of Romanian men moved in next door to you, would you be concerned? O'Brien, what about if a group of German children did? What's the difference? Farage, the difference? And you know what the difference is. O'Brien, no, I honestly don't. And I think this is the disconnect between your position and mine. The difference, of course, is that racists throughout history have insisted that certain minorities have a particular proclivity to criminality, that it is somehow in their DNA. It is most often seen in the context of defending the disproportionate and indiscriminate use of stop-and-search powers against young black men. Farage's entire career has been built on variations of the same theme. Accordingly, he was soon talking about Roma criminals and people traffickers. O'Brien, I asked you a question about Romanians and you started talking about people traffickers. Why didn't you say people are perfectly entitled to say that they feel uncomfortable about living next door to people traffickers, wherever they're from? Why do you say Romanians? Farage, I didn't say Romanians. Fleet Street was united in describing the encounter as a car crash and potentially career-ending for Farage. The Sun, and I had to double-check this, described his comments about Romanians as racism pure and simple. It makes you feel nostalgic for a bygone time. In reality, it barely constituted a bump in the road for Farage's bandwagon of bigotry. Later that week, he would lead UKIP to victory in the European elections and park his tanks on David Cameron's lawn. The Tory leader had already pledged in 2013 to hold a referendum on EU membership if he won the 2015 election. It was an unsuccessful bid to hold his own party together, and UKIP's success in the 2014 European elections changed the game. In August, the Tory backbencher Douglas Carswell defected to UKIP and won the subsequent by-election in Clacton. In September, Mark Reckless, another backbench nonentity afforded momentary celebrity by Tory infighting, announced his defection to UKIP from the stage of the party's annual conference in Doncaster. He too won the subsequent by-election in Rochester and Strood, although he lost his seat 4 months later at the general election that saw David Cameron prevail against Ed Miliband. It was a victory that rendered the referendum inevitable. And in his victory speech on the 7th of May 2015, Cameron confirmed that he would call a simple in-out ballot after negotiating a new settlement for Britain in the EU. Cameron's pink-cheeked triumphalism on the night was nothing if not hubristic. He did not realise it at the time, but two of the most fundamentally and flagrantly dishonest politicians in British history, Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson, already had his political balls in a vice. It is a peculiar vagary of the British political system that claims made in washing powder adverts are subject to much more stringent scrutiny than claims made in political advertising. Consider first this syrupy voiceover from a campaign video made and distributed by Farage's Leave.eu campaign in the run-up to the 2016 referendum. It has high production values and a cast of smiling, almost exclusively white characters enjoying life in a notional post-Brexit UK. The comparison with the post-Brexit reality of 2023 is, even for seasoned chroniclers of our self-inflicted decline, close to tear-inducing. It is also a handy reminder why, for many years after the vote, I used my radio show to seed the notion that we should have contempt for the con men and compassion for the conned. Watching this now, it is hard to fault anybody who fell for it. Funded by a £7 million donation loan from insurance tycoon Aaron Banks, later apparently written off by the businessman, Farage finally had the financial backing to add a patina of professionalism to his spiv's patter. You'll benefit from better care from the NHS thanks to the reallocation of funds from the EU budget. Controlled immigration will lead to reduced waiting times for you and your loved ones. The excess funding that would otherwise be sent to Brussels could also be directed to education, meaning better prospects for your children. Your wages will rise thanks to better controlled immigration, which will lead to less competition for jobs. Your weekly food shop will become cheaper. Food prices will no longer be inflated by agricultural policies controlled by the EU. You and your family will benefit from a resurgent economy led by new and flourishing small businesses, following the removal of burdensome EU regulations and red tape. With less pressure on housing, younger generations will also find it easier to get on the housing ladder. Politicians, both local and national, will become more accountable, helping to strengthen your community and others, especially those most damaged by EU policies, like farming, fishing, and industries like steel. A more prosperous and safer future awaits us outside the EU. A vote to leave is a vote for a brighter future for you, your family, and your community. Nobody will ever be held to account for this epic misrepresentation of what Brexit would deliver. Instead, its progenitors insist variously that everyone knew exactly what they were voting for, and that anyone pointing out the gulf between what was promised and what was delivered should move on, or that the mythical Brexit described above could have been delivered were it not for some enormous unspecified betrayal. In other words, there is a brilliant Brexit. It just goes to a different school. We are not concerned here with the full gamut of Farage's lies and deceptions. That would take a library. We are concerned chiefly with the creation of the media and political environment in which those lies and base bigotries could be first rejected by the mainstream, then tolerated, and finally enthusiastically embraced. More than anyone else, he created the climate whereby the Home Secretary would boast about her dream of seeing front pages reporting the deportation of genuine refugees to a country where refugees are shot. He created the climate where an immigration minister would order cartoons at a processing centre for unaccompanied child asylum seekers be painted over. And here, one episode stands above all others as evidence of just how low he was prepared to go, just how unspeakable he was prepared to be, and just how easily he would, by the time of the referendum, get away with behaviour that would have been unthinkable just 2 years previously. On the 16th of June 2016, exactly 1 week before the referendum vote, Leave EU unveiled a poster. It showed a caravan of largely Syrian refugees crossing the border between Slovenia and Croatia on their way to a refugee camp. It featured the caption, "Breaking Point," below which appeared the words, "The EU has failed us all." Across the bottom of the billboard, in front of which Farage posed for press photographers, it said, "Break free of the EU and take control of our borders." It bore a marked resemblance to a particularly virulent example of Nazi propaganda, which deployed similarly framed footage with the captions, "Who flooded Europe's cities after the last war, parasites undermining their host countries and bringing with them crime, corruption and chaos." Hours after the poster was unveiled, Joe Cox was shot dead by a white supremacist terrorist. During his victory speech a week later, Nigel Farage boasted that Brexit had been secured without a single bullet being fired. On the 27th of March 2017, Farage vowed that he would go and live abroad if Brexit failed. On the 15th of May 2023, he told the BBC, where he still has a season ticket, that Brexit has failed. Months later, he was to be found publicly bemoaning the fact that Coutts, the so-called millionaire's bank, had downgraded him to an ordinary account with the NatWest High Street Bank, either because he was no longer sufficiently solvent or because they feared being tainted by association. Both grounds seem perfectly reasonable, particularly for free marketeers. But Andrew Neil, the Daily Mail, the Telegraph, the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and the Home Secretary Suella Braverman all galloped to Farage's aid. He is yet to go and live abroad. Nick Griffin, meanwhile, announced in 2017 that he wanted to emigrate to Hungary. Weeks later, the government of Viktor Orban, who said in 2022 that "we Hungarians are not a mixed race and we do not want to become a mixed race," announced that Griffin was persona non grata and barred him from entering the country. Chapter 6, David Cameron. So what's happened to that twat David Cameron who called it on? How comes he can scuttle off? He called all this on. He's in Europe, in Nice, with his trotters up, yeah? Where is the geezer? I think he should be held account for it. He should be held account for it. Twat. Danny Dyer, Good Evening Britain, ITV, 28th of June, 2018. On the 15th of June 1988, the Deputy Director of the Conservative Research Department received an unscheduled telephone call from Buckingham Palace. It concerned an apparently unremarkable young man who had found himself unexpectedly jobless. Recent Oxford graduate David Cameron had, by his own admission, failed to secure a lucrative berth in the City of London through the post-university milk round of interviews with financial institutions and consultancies. Among the many unimpressed interviewers had been a young and highly regarded management consultant at McKinsey called William Hague. Cameron's ambitions to enter journalism had, like his future friend and colleague George Osborne's, also come to naught. Happily for him, although not necessarily for anyone else, he had at least one admirer in high places. "I understand that you are to see David Cameron," said the distinctly grand man from the palace. I've tried everything I can to dissuade him from wasting his time on politics, but I have failed. You are about to meet a truly remarkable young man. History relates neither the grounds for this encomium nor the identity of its deliverer. Contenders included Sir Alistair Aird, then equerry to the Queen Mother and the husband of Cameron's godmother, and Sir Brian McGrath, a friend of his parents, serving at the time as private secretary to Prince Philip. Another godparent, the Conservative MP Tim Rathbone, had provided young Cameron with employment at Parliament during his gap year between school and university. These links alone provide a snapshot of a class system so entrenched and unquestioned by its beneficiaries that when Cameron became Prime Minister of the United Kingdom just 12 years later, it seemed, to him at least, the most natural thing in the world. I felt exhausted, elated, but strangely at ease, he wrote later of the moment he was clapped into Downing Street by staff after winning the 2010 election, aged just 43 and with no serious frontline political experience. Not at ease in an entitled born-to-rule sense, but because there is such a warmth from all the people in that building and, for me, at least some familiarity. Attacking inherited privilege can sometimes seem as boneheaded as defending it. Wealth and advantage do not necessarily prevent having empathy for those less privileged or confer an inability to appreciate injustice. George Orwell, for example, is, like Cameron, an alumnus of Eton College. But so, at the time of Cameron's Downing Street installation, had been 20 other prime ministers, every one of them conservative. It is foolish not to recognise how this simple fact rubbishes any notion that Britain is a meritocracy, or how much it suggests that David Cameron would have got nowhere near Downing Street if he had attended what Alistair Campbell famously described as a bog-standard comprehensive school. Similarly, without understanding Cameron's ease and prominence in a social hierarchy forged to run the empire and bake inequality into every stratum of society, we cannot hope to understand the patrician insouciance with which he would lead the United Kingdom over a cliff. He'll go down in history as the man who gambled everything on a referendum and lost, effectively blowing half a century of economic and diplomatic effort on the part of his predecessors. Timothy Bale, Professor of Politics at Queen Mary University of London, told USA Today on the 13th of July 2016 in an interview marking Cameron's resignation. Subsequent events, of course, have shown that Professor Bale, always an acute observer of events, was rather understating the scale of Cameron's grim legacy, which is by no means confined to Brexit. In modern times, there have always been at least two conservative parties. One side, the establishment vehicle of monarchy and aristocracy, and almost but not quite conversely the other side, the home for aspirational and ambitious people who believe the system has rewarded, or will soon reward, their own hard work and abilities with a perch on a higher rung. Electoral success always depends upon persuading enough of the electorate that those rewards are within reach for them if, and only if, the Tories are in power. The American author John Steinbeck encapsulated the conundrum in 1960, writing, "Socialism never took root in America because the poor see themselves not as an exploited proletariat, but as temporarily embarrassed millionaires." Cameron's immediate Tory predecessors in Downing Street had been resolutely in the second category. The grammar school boy, Edward Heath, the grocer's daughter, Margaret Thatcher, and the former bus conductor, John Major. Their successors, while in opposition to the Blair-Brown government, had been born with similarly unsilvered spoons. The former political prodigy, William Hague, the shape-shifting, CV-finagling Ian Duncan Smith, and the Romanian refugee's son, Michael Howard. Nearly three decades in the background had not, however, extinguished the conservative contingent that did indeed consider themselves born to rule. They had merely been biding their time. Cameron's family tree is peppered with politicians and baronets, one below an earl, if you care to know. Unlike the perspicacious actor and remorseful Leave voter quoted at the very top of this chapter, he did not need to go on genealogy TV to learn that he is descended from a king, William IV, and is a distant cousin to Queen Elizabeth II. His father-in-law, Sir Reginald Sheffield, is a multi-millionaire and, like his own maternal grandfather, an old Etonian baronet. In his autobiography, Cameron describes an idyllic childhood in rural Berkshire, interrupted when he was, aged 7, sent to Heatherdown boarding school near Ascot. the alma mater of Princes Andrew and Edward, alongside sundry aristocrats and the progeny of various plutocrats, as well, of course, as the children of aspirational middle-class professionals unblessed by inherited wealth or privilege. While successive Tory governments would leave many schools lucky to possess playing fields, Heatherdown had a miniature railway that chuffed around the grounds while visitors to the school sports day passed through one of three entrances, ladies, gentlemen, or chauffeurs. I received a similar, less gilded schooling, although my family circumstances were and remain markedly different from Cameron's. I have written at length about the emotional privations of such environments and the grisly consequences of having rulers raised in them. Another old Etonian, Cyril Connolly, perhaps put it best when he wrote in his seminal 1938 memoir, Enemies of Promise, "Were I to deduce any system from my feelings on leaving Eton, it might be called the theory of permanent adolescence. It is the theory that the experiences undergone by boys at the great public schools, their glories and disappointments, are so intense as to dominate their lives and to arrest their development. From these, it results that the greater part of the ruling class remains adolescent, school-minded, self-conscious, cowardly, sentimental, and, in the last analysis, homosexual." 21st century sensibilities render the final line ridiculous, but another, better known one from the same source could have been written with Cameron in mind. Whom the gods wish to destroy, they first call promising. In his own breezy and understandably defensive memoir, Cameron sounds like most boys who have been taught from an early age that a stiff upper lip is more valuable than emotional literacy. Beatings, we learn, were commonplace at Heatherdown, naked communal bathing considered normal, and maggots in the food a comical culinary hazard. You learn early not to care about such things, because the alternative is to succumb to the casual cruelties and brutalizations typical of such schools until relatively recently. At the same time, admitting to mistakes or simply to being wrong about something is inconceivable. It would be a sign of weakness and opens chinks in the armour built simply to survive school and soon hardened into a second skin. What Cyril Connolly so presciently identified as permanent adolescence is now a growing and compelling field of academic study known as boarding school syndrome. In reference to this deliberate breaking of familial bonds shown to shape a child for life, John Bowlby, a psychoanalyst renowned for his work on child and parent attachments, once said that he wouldn't send a dog away to boarding school aged 7. After Heatherdown, Eton, where even more of the offspring of Britain's rich and powerful are educated. Princes William and Harry are alumni. A 16-year-old Boris Johnson wrote in the school magazine The Eton Chronicle that the education imbues its beneficiaries with the most important thing, a sense of his own importance. Self-awareness, alas, proved rather harder to teach. School fees are currently around £50,000 per annum, and students wear tailcoats and white ties to classes. It is obviously an absurd environment in which to place a child, until, that is, you remember that it is an environment originally designed to make men of empire, who never question their right to rule over any part of the world they choose. Cameron has written of a strong academic pressure to be a success in the classroom and powerful social pressure to be a success on the playing field. The pressure, however, was not sufficient to see him achieve either, until the end of his school days when, after disappointing O-levels, his A-level results proved sufficient to secure a place at Oxford University. In One of Them, a magnificent memoir of his own time at Eton, the author Musa Akwanga recalled, "Visible effort is mocked at my school. The trick is to achieve without seeming to try." This obsession with effortless success is the bizarre bedfellow of permanent competition. "Etonians have to compete for office within the school," explains another old boy, Nick Fraser, in his book, The Importance of Being Eton. He in turn quotes the former Conservative minister, Jonathan Aitken, whose own propensity to lie to win at all costs would see him end up in prison. "It breeds a sudden speciality of behaviour. You know how to get elected, you know how to please. You have to learn to oil, and at Eton you do learn." Oiling is best understood as networking, based on an understanding that in the upper reaches of British society, connections and contacts have always mattered more than intelligence, talent, or integrity. The tragedy of David Cameron, and in many ways of modern Britain, is that the skills required to succeed in these ridiculous citadels of entitlement and emotional illiteracy translate wholesale into the world of politics or business or, as we have seen, the popular media. And if at first you don't succeed, then, like Cameron, try another path until you achieve the sort of status you believe to be your birthright. If you are particularly well-oiled, you might even enlist help from a palace panjandrum. And when enough of the general public look at a Cameron or a Johnson or even a Jacob Rees-Mogg and judge them their betters, it becomes much easier to understand how, from 2010 onwards, the United Kingdom endured successive governments populated by politicians of unprecedented mediocrity. I know better than most that attempting to secure sympathy for men who enjoyed unfair advantages is an often thankless task, and I won't essay it again here. But while these schools are bastions of privilege and springboards to the highest echelons of society, they can leave their alumni emotionally crippled and so unable to acknowledge personal pain that they approach the world in a state of constant vigilance. Everything is a competition where winning is all that matters. Consider Cameron's response when his Eton contemporary Boris Johnson was hospitalised with coronavirus, an obviously lethal disease, and then moved to intensive care. "Boris is a very tough, very resilient, very fit person," he said. "I know that from facing him on the tennis court, and I'm sure he'll come through this." In short, this deadly virus, already responsible for the death of thousands of ordinary people, can somehow be countered with belligerence and sports skills. This daft but, in serious circumstances, deeply dangerous attitude lies at the heart of Cameron's unavoidably warped worldview and sowed the earliest political seeds of the catastrophes that would follow. In contrast to his more ordinary predecessors, Cameron was possessed of both epic entitlement and the emotionally stunted public schoolboy's deep psychological need to win. Consequently, he would usher in an era where truth would be subjugated by political expediency and national interest dwarfed by self-interest. For all his carefully contrived hugger-hoodie conviviality, we shall see that David Cameron's unnecessarily cruel policies, his political and personal carelessness, and profound cowardice in the face of epochal challenge set the scene for the depravity of Johnson's premiership, the madness of Liz Truss's, and, under Rishi Sunak, the Farageification of his own party. But first, Oxford. Haunted, according to his autobiography, by fears that he might turn out to be just another public school mediocrity, Cameron applied himself to his studies and emerged with a first-class degree. And while his tutor recalls that Cameron didn't lose sleep over philosophical problems and had a preference for instinct over introspection, it would be churlish not to recognise the scale of this achievement. Unlike many conservative politicians who would flourish in the wake of Brexit, he is clearly not stupid. But his student days were also taken up with membership of the Bullingdon Club, commemorated in an infamous 1987 photograph that saw him and nine other men, Boris Johnson and George Osborne among them, apparently competing to appear the most arrogant and entitled. Johnson's journalist sister Rachel described it as elitist, arrogant, privileged, and of an age that would have little resonance with people on low incomes who didn't go to Eton. When the picture's depiction of haughty condescension began to plague Cameron's attempts to portray himself as being in touch with ordinary people, its copyright holders withdrew permission for the image to be reproduced. It has never been established what strings were pulled or favours promised to achieve this, but it was a largely futile exercise. Soon, the BBC's Newsnight programme had even commissioned a portrait to circumvent the ban. The late poet, polemicist and playwright Heathcote Williams, like George Orwell, an avowedly iconoclastic old Etonian, made a study of the Bullingdon in his eviscerating 2016 volume Brexit Boris from Mare to Nightmare. "The Bullingdon Club," he wrote, "is for plutocratic undergraduates who think nothing of spending £3,500 on its royal blue tailcoats with ivory lapels and canary yellow waistcoats. A livery which prompted Evelyn Waugh in Brideshead Revisited to describe Bullingdon members as looking like a lot of most disorderly footmen." He recounts an episode which, had it featured two future Labour prime ministers, we would almost certainly have heard more about in the intervening years. At one club meal in 1987, attended by both Boris Johnson and David Cameron, someone whose identity has never been properly established thanks to the Bullingdon rule of omerta, threw a large plant pot through the restaurant window. The burglar alarm was activated and Oxford's police force duly descended on the dining club's chosen venue with sniffer dogs in tow. Six of the group were apprehended and spent the night at Cowley Police Station. Cameron escaped, but Johnson's attempt to evade the police by running off and crawling through a hedge in the Botanical Gardens failed, and by his own account, an overnight stay in a police cell reduced him to a gibbering namby-pamby. The tale tallies with the journalist Barney Roney's memories of his Oxford contemporaries who joined the club. "There's the air of lurking violence," he wrote, "and above all, the sense that its members consider themselves above the law on such occasions." Williams also reports that another stock in trade of the Bullingdon initiation rituals was for newly elected members to visit Bond Square, where Oxford's homeless congregate, and to burn a £50 note in front of them by way of jeering at their misfortune. Cameron's retrospective contrition is unintentionally illustrative, as it demonstrates more regret over the damage the photograph did to his image than any of the violence or delinquency with which the club is associated. "When I look now at the much-reproduced photograph taken of our group of appallingly over-self-confident sons of privilege, I cringe," he reveals in his autobiography. "If I had known at the time the grief I would get for that picture, of course I would never have joined." So Cameron left Oxford and, as we have established, failed to get a job in either the City of London or on Fleet Street that he felt would be deserving of his monumental talents. But of course, the call from the palace did its work, and in 1988, the year after the Bullingdon photograph was taken, David Cameron arrived at the Conservative Research Department, CRD. He would stay there for 5 years. In 1991, just 3 years after graduating, he was tasked with briefing John Major for Prime Minister's questions. Judged a success in the role, he was rewarded with the leadership of the political section of the CRD. During the 1992 general election campaign, he was back at John Major's side, assuming responsibility for preparing the Prime Minister for press conferences. Following Major's widely unexpected victory, his star was in the ascendancy and he became special advisor to Norman Lamont, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. He arrived in the job just in time for Black Wednesday, the 1992 financial crisis that saw Major's government forced to withdraw sterling from the European Exchange Rate Mechanism, ERM, after failing to keep the exchange rate above the required level. Still just 27, and no doubt aware that Major was now highly unlikely to win another election, David Cameron temporarily quit politics in 1994 and determined that a proper job in the private sector would burnish his political credentials. It was time for more oiling. In September 1994, he was appointed Director of Corporate Affairs at the television company Carlton Communications, headed by the Executive Chairman Michael Green. "The former special advisor had pulled strings to land the post," explained the Financial Times in 2010. "Annabel Astor, his future mother-in-law, persuaded Mr. Green to take on a man with no corporate PR or investor relations experience." Cameron was a qualified success in the role. Green was delighted, but journalists compelled to deal with him were less impressed, with the FT revealing, "In a series of run-ins with financial journalists, Mr. Cameron developed a reputation for arrogance, evasiveness and, in one case, alleged mendacity that dogged him during his attempt to become Tory leader in 2005 and may resurface during the imminent general election campaign." In 1997, when he took leave from Carlton to fight what should have been a safe Tory seat, Stafford, he was not expecting to return. Boundary changes to the constituency and the scale of Tony Blair's landslide general election victory, however, dictated otherwise, and Cameron was back at Carlton from where, it is fair to say, few suspected he would subsequently scale the political heights. "I have to pinch myself when I think he could become Prime Minister," a senior business journalist told The Guardian in 2010. "I can still picture him wringing his hands behind Michael Green's back. It's like that saying from the US, they say anyone can become president. And now I'm starting to believe it." In the 2001 election, having been gifted an even safer seat to fight, David Cameron became the MP for Witney in Oxfordshire and began to rise almost without trace through the party ranks. It was, crucially, a party in dire political straits. William Hague's crushing defeat in 1997 had seen the party turn in desperation to a supremely unqualified candidate, Ian Duncan Smith. Beset by innate incompetence and, it quickly emerged, a distinctly casual attitude to the truth when it came to his own background and achievements, even the ravaged party realised that leaving him in post to fight a general election would be catastrophic. A vote of confidence in 2003 saw him become the first leader since Neville Chamberlain not to lead the party into a general election. He has since been joined on that ignominious roster by Liz Truss. The best available candidate to replace him proved to be Michael Howard, the shadow chancellor who the Conservative Party elected as their leader unopposed. Like William Hague, but unlike Ian Duncan Smith, History will judge Michael Howard more kindly than contemporary commentators and colleagues. He led the party to its third consecutive defeat in 2015, but reduced Labour's majority from 167 to 66. Crucially, after determining to step down as leader, he set about preparing the party for the future by comprehensively reshuffling his front bench in May, with at least one eye on the question of a potential successor. David Cameron was made Shadow Secretary of State for Education, and George Osborne became Shadow Chancellor. In yet another example of how intertwined opaquely funded think tanks are with the modern Conservative Party, Daniel, now Lord Finkelstein, variously the Chairman of Policy Exchange, Director of the CRD, Advisor to William Hague, and Executive Editor, Associate Editor and Columnist on Rupert Murdoch's Times, recalled in 2010, "Before the 2005 general election, a small group of us, myself, David Cameron, George Osborne, Michael Gove, Nick Bowles, Nick Herbert, I think, once or twice, used to meet up in the offices of Policy Exchange, eat pizza, and consider the future of the Conservative Party. And we were stumped. It's not that we didn't understand what needed to be done. It is that we couldn't work out how to make it happen. All our theories about how to modernise the party just seemed impossible to deliver under any conceivable leader. That is because we hadn't properly considered that David himself could be leader." By September 2005, when the race to replace Howard began in earnest, Cameron was a contender, but David Davis, the Shadow Home Secretary, was the hot favourite. "It was a big decision to run, and I didn't do it lightly," Cameron said later. "I always thought there was a good prospect, a fair prospect of winning the competition to become leader. That may sound arrogant." If it was arrogant, it was well placed. A speech delivered without notes, a speciality of public school debating chambers, at the Conservative Party conference in October, changed the game. "Some say that we should move to the right," he said. "I say that will turn us into a fringe party, never able to challenge for government again. I don't want to let that happen to this party. Do you?" he continued. "To the family trying to keep their heads above water to provide for their kids and to give them the time they need, we'll say yes, we believe in the family, because the most important thing in the world is that children are brought up in a stable, loving home." Bolstered by Davis's lacklustre performance, he was snapping at the older man's heels in the first ballot of MPs. Daniel Finkelstein was also on hand to help, writing in his Times column, "Some Conservatives, whom I greatly respect, gave Mr. Davis their support on the ground that he might prove a modernising leader. This hypothesis has now been disproved. They should not feel bound to him any longer." By the second ballot, Cameron was streets ahead, securing 90 votes to Davis's 57. The margin of victory when the decision was put to the wider party membership was greater still. On the 6th of December 2005, David Cameron's election as leader of the Conservative Party was announced. On the 13th of July 2016, resigning as Prime Minister after setting in motion a chain of events that would scupper the country and see his own party lurch violently to the right, he told the House of Commons accurately that, "I was the future once." In his acceptance speech, he promised a more compassionate conservatism, right for our times and right for our country. But behind the platitudes, it was, and still remains, difficult to discern precisely what David Cameron stood for or believed in. In this, to be fair, he is not unique. After the 1997 defeat, the future universities minister, David Willetts, asked Dennis Thatcher what he thought the party should do next. He replied, "Get back to basic conservative principles. But don't ask me what they are." Cameron, however, had become leader and would shortly become Prime Minister, not a Prime Minister's spouse, without ever providing much indication of why he wanted the job. The former MP and new Labour communications guru Peter Mandelson shared a telling anecdote in his 2010 memoir. "He has a certain born-to-rule thing about him, a sense of entitlement, somebody who thinks that he would be good at governing and being Prime Minister. Indeed, I always remember the editor of the Daily Telegraph telling me a year ago, when they had Cameron to dinner, the first question they asked him was, 'Well, why do you want to be Prime Minister?' And he said, 'Because I think I'd be good at it.'" The omens were not great. During the leadership campaign, Cameron had made just one substantive policy promise to the party. It concerned, perhaps inevitably, Europe. And it provides a helpful, albeit harrowing, harbinger of what would follow. In the hope of placating the right-wing headbangers of the Cornerstone group of MPs, Cameron pledged that he would lead Tory MEPs out of the main centre-right grouping in the European Parliament, the European People's Party, EPP. This was an immediate break from cooperative union with like-minded centre-right European counterparts and left the Tory party in bed with much more extreme European right-wing parties. William Hague, probably the Tories' most Eurosceptic leader to date, had not gone near the policy, And David Davis had declined to sign up to the withdrawal pledge during the leadership contest. It marks the first example of David Cameron eschewing cooperation and engagement with allies and equals in the EU and preferring to pander to the whims of his own party's lunatic fringe. Cornerstone, dubbed Tombstone by critics, contained political geniuses such as John Redwood, Nadine Dorries, and future hard man of Brexit, Steve Baker. This departure prompted Conservative MEP Caroline Jackson to declare, "David Cameron's decision on the EPP is pathetic and will sow the seeds of endless trouble. It will leave David Cameron and Shadow Foreign Secretary William Hague very isolated because it will leave bad blood with Christian Democrat parties throughout Europe. It is a stupid, stupid policy. The Tories are doing this because the party is run by people whose ultimate agenda is to pull Britain out of the EU. I have been a member of the Conservative Party since 1963 and started working for the Conservative Research Department in 1973. This is one of the most dotty escapades the Conservative Party had ever embarked on." The Shadow Business Secretary, Kenneth Clark, had described the pledge as rather dangerous in 2006, but revealed in 2009 that the party leadership had assured him that Tory MEPs would not be sitting with neo-fascists or cranks or anything of this kind. In the event, the 26 Tory MEPs elected in 2009 became the largest contingent in the newly formed European Conservatives and Reformists group. Poland's opposition Law and Justice Party, some of whose members had expressed homophobic and anti-German views, had the second largest number of MEPs in the new group. Latvia's For Fatherland and Freedom, or LNNK party, was also part of the new coalition. Some of its members celebrated the Latvian Legion, the Latvian units of the Waffen-SS. Their MEPs would, perhaps, have fitted in at Andrew Neil's spectator summer parties, but made a strange bedfellow for British Tories in 2009. At the time, most future Remainers failed to note the significance of Cameron's weakness in this case, but the words of Ed Davey, then the Liberal Democrats' foreign affairs spokesman and now the party's leader, have proved prescient. "The Conservatives have opted to throw away influence in Europe in favour of ideological isolationism. Conservative political leaders in Paris, Berlin and Rome must be shaking their heads in disbelief, while President Obama will be shocked that a party that hopes to be the government of Britain would associate with a range of fringe parties, most of which have minimal influence in their home countries." By contrast, Marc Francois, the shadow Europe minister who would go on to become one of the most reliably ridiculous Brexiteers, insisted that they were very excited about this important new development in European politics. It may not have been clear at the time, but the headbangers were now calling the tune, and Cameron was already dancing to it. On the 18th of December 2005, Cameron gave his first newspaper interview as party leader. That he chose The Observer was evidence of his determination to appeal beyond traditional Tory territories. Reading it now, three things stand out. The first, once again, is the hideous transformation his party has undergone in the 18 years since. In 2023, as we have seen, senior Tories compete over who can be most deliberately cruel and callous towards refugees and asylum seekers. In 2005, their shiny-faced young leader stated, "I'm passionately committed to giving people who are being tortured and persecuted asylum, and that means not just letting them in, but taking them to our hearts and feeding and clothing and schooling them." Second, the blasé acknowledgement of what would prove to be a serious flaw. "I'm not a deeply ideological person. I'm a practical person and pragmatic. I know where I want to get to, but I'm not ideologically attached to one particular method." And third, between the lines, the reason why not believing in anything much or seeming to care particularly deeply about politics didn't set off more alarm bells at the time. The 2008 financial crisis was barely a speck on the horizon. Economic stability had been taken for granted for years. Austerity belonged to a different age. The prospect of war in Europe was an almost unthinkable idea, and few people knew precisely what constituted a pandemic. There was, in other words, no obvious danger in having a prospective prime minister so removed from the implications of his policies that he would boast the following year that, "I probably have more hinterland than front end. For me, family, friends and home are the most important thing in my life. If politics interfered with that too much, I'd call it a day." The Greeks, as ever, have a word for it. Hamartia is the fatal flaw that will bring down even the most highly favoured hero. Cameron's was a combination of ambition for ambition's sake, self-importance and complacency. Ed Miliband, whom he would defeat in the 2015 general election, once observed that Cameron did not really want to be Prime Minister, he just wanted to have been Prime Minister. From a rather different political perspective, Rupert Murdoch told The New Yorker that Cameron was charming, he's very bright, and he behaves as if he doesn't believe in anything other than trying to construct what he believes will be the right public image. He's a PR guy. The opposite, in other words, of his opponent in the 2010 election, Gordon Brown. Doer, detail-obsessed, irascible, and perhaps crucially, unpolished enough to be accidentally recorded describing Gillian Duffy, a voter who had buttonholed him with tabloid-fresh immigration scare stories during the campaign, as that bigoted woman. Whether through personal flaws, widespread media enmity, or a combination of both, during the May 2010 election, Brown failed to capitalize on his genuinely world-leading response to the 2008 financial crisis. In October of that year, Brown and his Chancellor, Alistair Darling, persuaded skeptical G7 and EU leaders that recapitalization of banks was the only way to avert catastrophe. The scale of this achievement is all the more impressive as Brown hadn't originally been invited to the definitive meeting of Eurozone leaders in France, but, having received a late invitation from the French President Nicolas Sarkozy, ended up persuading everyone present to follow the British model. On the evening of the 14th of October at 8:30 Paris time, Sarkozy stepped out of the Élysée to tell the assembled media that those present had agreed in broad principle to follow Gordon Brown's recapitalization schemes. Back in London, after an overnight flight from Washington where he had secured similar success, Alistair Darling imposed stringent bailout conditions on British banks that had teetered on the brink of collapse just 2 days earlier on Black Friday. He prevailed. It was, by any standards, a remarkable display of economic acumen and international statesmanship by Brown and Darling, who would later admit that he believed, "We faced a situation where the banking system right across the world, never mind Britain, could have collapsed." Yet David Cameron, his colleagues and their client media would shamelessly lie about what had happened that weekend and what had caused the crisis for the duration of the 2010 election campaign and seemingly, at the time of writing, for the rest of their lives. It is impossible to exaggerate the egregiousness of the lie that propelled Cameron into Downing Street in coalition with Nick Clegg's Liberal Democrats and formed the foundation stone of his ruinous program of austerity. 13 years later, in 2023, the party chairman Greg Hands was still desperately referring on Twitter, or X, almost daily, to a valedictory line written by Liam Byrne, Chief Secretary of the Treasury, addressed to his successor that said, "I'm afraid there is no money." The grossly fallacious idea that the 2008 economic meltdown was due to Labour's public sector spending, as opposed to a banking crisis born largely from the American subprime mortgage scandal, was absolutely crucial to Cameron and, even more so, his Chancellor George Osborne. How, asked the former Labour MP Chris Mullin in 2015, did the party of bankers, hedge funders and light-touch regulation manage to turn what was by any measure a crisis of capitalism into a crisis for the public sector? The answer is now depressingly familiar. Blatant lies, media complicity, and an absence of accountability and integrity at the heart of government. All the talk of Gordon Brown's debt, the mess that Labour left us, and the chaos we inherited, not only justified austerity and defied reality. In fact, Cameron's government inherited a growth rate of 1.9% that would not be exceeded until 2014, but also provided cover for their own fiscal failures. In the absence of proper journalism, everything undesirable or suboptimal could be blamed on Labour's legacy. Ironically, Cameron would eventually be undone by the fact that the same would soon be said of the EU, or Brussels, or even immigration. It is easy to trace both the casual misrepresentations by Vote Leave and the delinquency with which they were treated by the Fourth Estate to the lies and nonsenses of Gordon Brown's debt. One wonders just how emboldened Cameron's cabinet colleagues turned referendum opponents were by witnessing just how easy it was to escape the blame. "Lives lost, earnings lost, years lost," wrote the Financial Times chief data reporter John Byrne Murdoch at the end of 2022. Unlike Trussonomics, austerity is a slow and silent killer. For the best part of 12 years, the Conservatives sowed the seeds. This year, they're reaping the harvest. He explained, If you're lucky, you can get away with cutting investment for a few years. Everything gets a bit more fragile, but as long as there are no nasty external shocks, you might be able to avoid disaster. The effects of slashing public services are a little harder to hide, but you might get away with gradual deterioration. The problem is, when you're hit by a pandemic, an energy crisis, and an act of gross economic self-sabotage in short order, your now brittle and exhausted public services will buckle where a healthy system would have taken the strain. Bern Murdoch's crunching of OECD numbers paints a grim picture, particularly when graphs are adjusted to show the precise point at which Cameron came to power. Underpinning an almost unprecedented period of national decline are the swingeing cuts to public spending and, crucially, the effective cessation of investment in public sector infrastructure. Cameron and Osborne's cuts went further and faster than comparable peer countries. Even healthcare, supposedly ring-fenced from austerity, went into steady decline from May 2010 because our aging, ailing population needed more spending, not the stagnation that Osborne deployed. Worse, and in contrast to those peer countries, as a share of GDP, public spending actually went down. Consequently, for example, by the end of 2022, the real term pay of nurses was a full 12% below where it stood before the 2010 election. The failure to invest in NHS infrastructure and technology, long before Boris Johnson started boasting about building fantasy hospitals, created a huge shortage of both beds and the equipment required to get patients quickly out of hospital. While Tories boasted about record numbers of doctors and record levels of funding, they entirely neglected the fact that their policies were making it measurably harder for those doctors to do their jobs. After years of falling under Labour, NHS waiting lists began to lengthen almost from the moment David Cameron walked into Downing Street. Other measures, such as being seen at A&E within 4 hours of arriving, reflect similar deterioration. The figures for avoidable deaths, or deaths that would simply not occur if the patient had been treated quickly and effectively, began climbing after years of coming down, while life expectancy slowed more quickly than in comparable populations. In October 2015, the independent health think tank the King's Fund found that under the Cameron-Osborne regime, the NHS had suffered its lowest annual average spending increase in real terms since it was founded in 1948, at around a quarter of the long-run average increase in funding since 1951. Soon there were unprecedented ambulance delays and the first ambulance driver and nurse strikes for 30 years. Then came the junior doctors, then the consultants. In July 2023, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak argued in the House of Commons that striking NHS staff were to blame for the total number of people on NHS waiting lists rising during the 9 months of his premiership. Despite the frequent insistence that we are all in this together, Cameron and Osborne, who cut the top tax rate for the country's highest earners in 2012, ushered in an era of almost unimaginable harm. The gap between rich and poor has widened. The young are now worse off than their parents were at the same age, and home ownership has declined steeply. After years of pay freezes, strikes are now so frequent that even the right-wing media no longer routinely reports them. People across the UK are dying younger. British children who grew up during austerity are measurably shorter than both previous generations and their European counterparts. In 2023, GPs in poorer areas of the country reported a resurgence of Victorian diseases such as rickets and scurvy. Nowhere was the cost of Cameron's brutal denigration of public services more evident than in the country's response to the COVID-19 outbreak. On the 16th of June 2023, Michael Marmot, Professor of Epidemiology and Public Health at University College London, told the independent COVID-19 inquiry that the UK entered the pandemic with its public services depleted, health improvement stalled, health inequalities increased, and health among the poorest people in a state of decline. Typically, and deliberately with austerity policies, the poorest areas of the country were the most affected. Marmot added, the greater the deprivation of the area, the steeper the cuts in social care spend. In the most deprived 20% of areas, it went down by 32%. In the least deprived, it went down by 3%. The contribution that austerity made to the Brexit vote can feel almost trivial in comparison to its impact on healthcare and the COVID-19 response. It isn't. The squeeze on incomes of ordinary people was a major contributory factor in support for Brexit-supporting political parties. Between 2010 and 2016, just as their social capital was being deliberately eroded, the people of Britain saw zero-hours contracts and food banks proliferate. Bern Murdoch shows that, even in 2022, real wages are below where they were 18 years ago. There has not been a single year since austerity began when the average wage has matched the peak under the last Labour government. In September 2017, the Institute for Labour Economics, an international non-profit research institute comprising around 2,000 scholars from more than 60 countries, published research that found unhappy feelings contributed to Brexit. However, contrary to commonly heard views, the key channel of influence was not through general dissatisfaction with life, it was through a person's narrow feelings about his or her own financial situation. In August 2019, Thiemo Fetsa, a professor in economics at the University of Warwick, went further. I gathered data from all electoral contests that took place in the UK since 2000 and assembled a detailed individual-level panel dataset covering almost 40,000 households since 2009. Through these data, I studied to what extent an individual's or region's exposure to welfare cuts since 2010 was associated with increased political support for UKIP in the run-up to the Brexit referendum in 2016. The analysis suggests that this association was so strong that the 2016 EU referendum would have resulted in a clear victory for Remain, or the referendum might never have happened, had it not been for austerity measures such as extensive cuts to public spending. In other words, David Cameron and George Osborne created the dissatisfaction and distress that would prompt many people to vote for Brexit. Into this space sashayed the deliberate and deceitful demonisation of workers from other EU countries perpetrated by Nigel Farage and co., and the unkeepable promises about prosperity punted by the likes of Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg, drawing on erroneous economic modelling. On the 3rd of November 2015, Patrick Minford, the lonely pro-Brexit economist who would later inspire Emily Maitlis's Minford paradigm, told the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, "We have done a simulation of leaving the EU. The first thing that comes out is an 8% drop in the cost of living on day one. Now that is really worth having." The previous April, launching a report by his Economists for Brexit group, Minford had said that his modelling also showed output would be 2% higher by the end of the decade, Britain would be 5% more competitive on global markets, and real wages would be 1.5% higher than if the UK remained in the EU. When David Cameron announced his intention to hold a referendum on EU membership on the